And welcome back to the Eye on College Football podcast here on CBSSports.com. I am Chip Patterson, and pleased to be joined today by Jeremy Fowler, college football insider. Jeremy spent the weekend at LSU, Georgia, and you did not get to witness a lot of the classic SEC defense down in Athens, did you?
There was a little bit of defense. I was trying to find it. Occasionally, you'd see a resemblance. I think it comes down to two really good quarterbacks and two really young defenses, and that's kind of the perfect concoction for a great classic game. Every game should be that way. And you're seeing that in the SEC now more and more this year. I don't consider the SEC a shootout league by any means. It's a product of some young defenses and probably four, maybe five really good quarterbacks if you count South Carolina's Connor Shaw. But four really good quarterbacks in the league. Anytime those teams are involved in playing a young defense, it's going to be very high scoring.
Your four M's, your Mettenberger, your Murray, your Manziel, your McCarron, they certainly are the class of the SEC. And I think you touched on this a little bit in your game column, and I agreed with it. You said young defenses, particularly the young secondaries. Georgia secondary, we knew it was going to be young coming into this game, and LSU, while that secondary may have looked like they were restocked and reloaded, they really hadn't faced any kind of offense quite on the level of Georgia. I wanted to get your opinion. What is your thought on LSU as a potential title contender for the SEC title, first of all? Because now they've got that one loss, but they still control their destiny playing Alabama and Texas A&M. They still could get to Atlanta. But with that being sort of LSU's first test, do you still think of them as, you know, right there in the mix with the rest of the SEC title contenders?
They can beat Alabama. Whether they will or not depends on if that defensive line gets a little better, because that's always been the calling card for LSU, dominant defensive lines. And early in the year, they looked pretty stout again. But Saturday, what worried me is zero sacks on Murray. And really minimal pressure. I mean, the guy was clean all day. I think that's what helped him play so well. He wasn't running for his life because he's a shorter quarterback. So if you can get pressure on him, you can beat him. And they just didn't do that. So that worries me a little bit. Plus the fact that their entire secondary is basically freshmen and sophomores at this point. It was just one of those games too. I mean, John Chavis is one of the most well-respected coordinators in the SEC, if not the country. And, you know, he's given up 44 points. So it's just kind of the way things are right now. But that offense is sort of a revelation right now. It's one of the most intriguing storylines in the country, I think, is the passing game, both the comfort level that Mettenberger seems to have with new coordinator Cam Cameron, and it's the fact that Cameron brings a sophistication to that offense that they really didn't have. You wonder where Les Miles would be if he had a passing game all these years, because they've contended, they have a national title, because they always run the ball well. And so this is a matter of having a quarterback that can really sling it if given time. You know, he's not a mobile guy, but with what they have going and some of the concepts they have with three or four receivers and empty sets, you know, you never see that with LSU. So it's an intriguing time for them.
Well, it has been suggested, and I wanted to get your opinion, do you think that this really is one of the first times in Les Miles' LSU tenure that he has kind of gone a little bit more hands-off the offense and has let Cam Cameron, his former boss, really sort of run the show without anyone over top of him?
Maybe, and that was part of the stipulation, I'm sure, of Cameron taking the job. You know, he probably, they're good friends, he and Les, and he probably kind of wanted to run his own show in order to come on board. I don't know the exact dynamics there. But they just, you know, they just didn't have the level of sophistication before. It's kind of not necessarily on the previous coordinators. I mean, I guess in some ways it is, but they just didn't have the same scheme or the same production. You ask around some other coaches, that's one of the first things they say is Cameron's made a huge difference. I think Miles is smart to kind of lay off. You know, Miles is a guy who knows fronts, offensive line, tight ends. That's his background. So he can always have some input there. But in this case, he doesn't really need to because, you know, the running game for them is always going to be pretty good. In fact, Georgia was you got to give them some credit for holding their running game in check, which is pretty rare these days with Jeremy Hill and that big line. But yeah, Steve Kragthorpe maybe could have been good for LSU, but he had his health problems, and then it just was kind of downhill from there, and they needed a change.
Jeremy Hill, of course, held to just 4.1 yards per carry, which against a talented back like Hill, certainly that is some success. Did you end up getting to meet up with Coach Grantham, defensive coordinator for Georgia?
Yeah, I was kind of playing with a few themes on how to write that because I met with him on Friday, and he showed me some film. It was pretty informative. It was of how they're going to prepare for LSU. And it was all based on the safeties, and we saw that play out a little bit during the game. You know, his thing was you got to stop the run, but you hope to do it with your front because, you know, with the passing game the way it is now, you can't really drop a safety in the box all the time and have eight-man fronts because they have a good passing game now to smoke you out, you know, downfield. I think Georgia was a little surprised that LSU really didn't go deep very often. I mean, they had some intermediate big gains, but that was more catching up within the 25 to 30 yard range. I think Grantham thought they were going to go deeper with the post more often, and they really didn't, you know, because they kind of run a basic concept where they have to get too X and O-ish. But you know, the LSU when they're you know, anytime they have a fullback in, you know, they're planning on running the ball, but they can make a check and just have a post on one side and then have just another shorter route. You know, a comeback route or something on the other side, and that's kind of what Georgia was ready for. So they were trying to kind of show their safety a little bit, but then be ready to bring them back every time, depending on the call. And so it's kind of a cat and mouse game. So it's pretty cool to watch some of that stuff. And they played it pretty safe. They were lucky. I think their game plan worked in the sense that their front seven was able to contain the running game, which helped them on the back end. But the problem is they still gave up almost 400 yards despite that. I guess that's sort of the give and take. You know, you have a young defense, good quarterback, some of that's going to happen. But, and they had a couple safety blitzes where it didn't work out and the corner's left one-on-one and gets burned, you know. So, I mean, things like that happen, I guess. But they took a few chances and some of them worked, some didn't.
I mean, you getting a win when you're going up with that young secondary against the likes of Jarvis Landry, Odell Beckham, and of course, Kadren Boone only had two catches in this game, but it is a dynamic set of receivers to defend. Georgia, you like them right now as the continued front runners in the East?
Yeah, I do. I just wonder if Florida and South Carolina are just a little too inconsistent for me. South Carolina is supposed to have a stout defense, but I want to say they're ranked like 70th in the country in certain categories, kind of on the back end there. Yeah, the UCF game was a little curious, although I'm pretty high on UCF's quarterback. It's still UCF. You could tell that Steve Spurrier wanted no business being in Orlando, Florida Saturday. you know, Florida, that's just you just don't know what you're going to get offensively still. I mean, I like Tyler Murphy to fill in for Jeff Driscoll, but you still need to see more of a body of work. I mean, he could, you know, shut it down here in 2 weeks and be terrible. We just don't know yet. I think he's pretty sharp and can help them. But they're going to win. You know, Florida's going to win like they did last year. They're going to drag it out, try to win 18-15 or 12-10 or whatever that's their thing right now. You know, Muschamp's always going to have a great defense. So, you know, the thing is they can't get over is, and this is maybe a problem for Georgia, and maybe they can overcome this, but to lose or to win three straight against Florida in a series that Florida had traditionally dominated for the last 15 years or so, that's hard to do. And so I don't know if they can pull that off. We'll see. Maybe they can. But, I still have Georgia right now. I picked them early in the year, and they haven't done anything to dissuade me from that.
Switching gears a little bit, sort of as – our go-to insider, Jeremy, the coaching carousel is just something that comes with the job. And unfortunately, you know, because I don't know if anyone ever really enjoys from the media side. I don't know if anyone really enjoys a coaching search, but it is certainly a big part of the job. And we're already spinning here after just a few weeks of college football with Lane Kiffin out at Southern Cal, with Paul Pasqualoni out at UConn. And in the fallout from Lane Kiffin's dismissal, Jeremy wrote a piece on CBSSports.com. Headline, Lane Kiffin's failure at USC, a cautionary tale for job hopping. And in the piece, I think that, Jeremy, you did a really good job of sort of hitting the pause button and backing up a little bit to reveal sort of this nature where almost one out of every three or four jobs is turning over in some sense right now, and a lot of coaches are rising up the chain very quickly, and it seems that more athletic directors want to win the hire, win the press conference. You're so concerned about, you know, getting something that's hot, and it's the continued trending aspect of our society. And, you know, maybe, as you suggested, Kiffin just rose too fast. And a job like Southern Cal, he just wasn't ready for, and this should be something that schools should, you know, take a step and think about what they're doing.
Right. Well, also coaches, they need to take a step and realize what they're doing. You look at a guy like Lane Kiffin, and maybe he wouldn't have succeeded anyways. Everybody kind of labels him a buffoon or a little dopey, and maybe that he never would have resonated at a big job. I don't know. But I wonder, he got off to at least a decent start at Tennessee, maybe would have had some NCAA trouble. But if he would have stayed, or maybe if he would have remained on the USC staff for longer and kind of, you know, develop as a coach and learn some things, you know, make your mistakes behind the scenes as opposed to as the Raiders coach or the USC coach. Sometimes if you're not ready and you rise too fast, and now what do? He's 38, and, you know, I'm sure he'll get a job somewhere as, like, maybe a position coach in the NFL or maybe in the media even, you know, get him on Fox or something. I don't know. But it's a weird deal. Who's going to hire that guy as a head coach in college in the next 3 years unless it's lower level? I mean, nobody. And so you wonder. I think coaches like a Pat Fitzgerald from Northwestern or James Franklin from Vanderbilt, they're already making really good money where they're at. I mean, they're not making $5 million a year, but yeah, I think Franklin's probably making close to $3 million. And so you have more job security. You know, you look at anybody in any walk of life, what do you want more than anything when you're an adult is, in some ways, you want job security, you know, as long as it's something that keeps you comfortable, provide for your family, all that. You know, I wonder if a guy like Fitzgerald has more job security staying at Northwestern than he would going to a USC where you're going to have a 2, maybe 3-year leash. If it doesn't get done, you're in bad shape. And some guys, you know, I don't knock guys for going for the big job. If you're confident and can do well, then you can crack the thing open and be the next Urban Meyer, Nick Saban maybe. And that's, you know, you can't maybe do that at where you're at if you can't win a national title. But, you know, I guess it comes down to what's important to you. Some guys like to job hop and get to the next great thing, and then they're done in 3 years.
Well, yeah, because once you get fired, you're going to be defined by whatever happened at that last job. And we've seen college coaches right now. I mean, I don't think that Cliff Kingsbury is destined to flame out, but Matt Campbell's young. I mean, we could go down a list. There's a lot of college football coaches under the age of 40, and they're rising faster. And I mean, am I too caught in the moment right now, or are more coaches taking that risk maybe because the money is so big now that the risk is actually worth it?
Well, there's that, and these guys are confident. They feel that they can do well. It's all about the fit, too. If somebody looks at USC and says, I can win there in 2-3 years, then do it. You know, but I don't know if Lane Kiffin went into that situation thinking he could win big at USC in a few years when you're going to have no scholarships. And I think they went to Arizona State, or what was it, a recent game I read, they had 56 scholarship players dressed out. You know, it's so hard to win that way. So it's easy to forget that with all Lane's problems at USC that he had, you know, that hanging over him. It's just hard for any coach to win that way. Bill O'Brien's going to go through a lot of the same. But he's, you know, he's considered a really sharp coach, and that's a little different. But, yeah, it comes down to what's important to you. And you mentioned Kingsbury. That's maybe a little bit of a different situation because Texas Tech is not as high profile where, you know, maybe you can – you know, it's still sort of a stepping stone job. Willie Taggart at USF the same way, although he's in a rough place right now. But, you know, if you can just kind of keep it together for a few years and parlay it into the next job, you know, maybe that's a job hopping situation. Or Kingsbury, heck, he might be loyal to the place where he played college, you know. It's a weird dynamic. There's so many factors, and on some level you have to take calculated risks. But I just think there are a lot of coaches right now that are in pretty good situations that might think twice about just going for the next big job.
How big a role are coaches' agents playing in the coaching carousel right now?
It's big. It's bigger on some levels than people think, and it's smaller on some levels than people think. I don't know that they're necessarily pulling all the strings because they have to they have to do what's best for their client. That's what they always say. And if you have a coach that wants the USC job, then that agent's going to try to happen. And so is the agent pulling the string there in some ways? Yeah, but, it depends on what the client wants. If you're Chris Peterson's agent and he wants to stay at Boise every year, you're not going to really change much. Now, you might, you certainly might use leverage. That's the thing that is growing more than anything is just the leverage game and these ADs kind of getting muscled out by agents that are getting contract extensions like crazy. I mean, guys get contract extensions after 1 year now. It's like clockwork. I mean, Todd Graham just got one after a year and two games. Rich Rod got one this offseason. And sometimes it's just like maintenance. You want to update his contract another year, maybe add a little more money, give him a small raise. But, it's interesting. I mean, these deals get reworked all the time. Kirk Ferentz can't fire him in Iowa because he makes a gazillion dollars in a buyout. I mean, I think it was close to $20 million at one point. So that's the power of agents. That's where they've made their mark. But they're doing what's best for their clients. So those guys have a good support system to fall back on in case they fail. Gene Chizik got, close to $7 million. So, when he got fired. So it's a good situation for those guys.
One more thing on coaching. Of course, one of your weekly features on CBSSports.com is Chasing the Devil, sort of a coaching and now a way to sort of rank the coaches, but in terms of, who Nick Saban is the class of the sport, who are the next coaches up. For last week, we had Urban Meyer and Oregon's Mark Helfrich both tied for the top spot with Jimbo Fisher and Les Miles behind them. Are you going to give us any sneak peek into what might be coming in this week's Chasing the Devil? Any spoilers?
Well, I keep moving up Sarkisian. He's in my top 10 now. And his start couldn't have been better. But, they've got two quality wins, maybe three if you count Illinois, although that's questionable. But they have the most efficient or most accurate quarterback in the Pac-12 right now and the best rusher in Bishop Sankey. And so couldn't have gone better, but they play Stanford this week. So is that going to change? That's at Stanford, really tough game. But he's in my top 10 for now. And then who else made a move this week? I'm trying to think. So Stoops is back in the top 10. Whatever you think about the Big 12, beating Notre Dame, even if Notre Dame's a little down, it's still a quality win for the league. It's on the road, and I just think Stoops' defense is so much more stout now, and they can do more with their coverages. They're a little deeper. So that's a big part of it. And then there was one more. Who did I move up? Drawing a blank on it. I'll think of it in a minute, but Rick's back in the top 5 now. He's kind of been all over the place. It's a weird list to do because there's so many coaches. It's hard to, I've been a little fickle knocking guys in and out of the top 10, but Rick is back.
Rick's back. Here we go. It's like Tiger Woods. Yeah. He's hit. Ricked in the hot seat. What did you say? Ricked is to hot seat as Tiger Woods is to back. It's just kind of a week-to-week thing.
Yeah, I like that. Yeah, he'll be fired next week.
Yeah, he'll be back on it. Another thing that sort of is new this year. Yeah, it is new this year. CBS Sports Network, you can watch Fast Football. Jeremy has been very, very involved with it. It is a sort of take on both the players, the schemes, the coaches, and also the technology that has continued to revolutionize the game of football, college football specifically. And I wanted to pitch this one to you. How fine is the line between gimmick and greatness when it comes to increasing these snap counts?
Gimmick and greatness. Well, that's a good question. I think the good defenses that go fast know when to go slow, too. Texas A&M is a good example of that. They can go fast when they want, but it's really about coaching and it's about anticipation. Yeah, I think a lot of offenses now can put up points and can put up yards, especially yards. The yards are outrageous right now, and you have bad offenses putting up 500 yards a game right now. But getting points is another thing. You see a lot of offenses that will go downfield and get to the red zone, but have to settle for field goals or turn it over. So the yards look great, but the points don't. I think the great fast offenses run the ball pretty well, run the ball better than you'd think. It's not a pass-happy deal, you know. And then they also know when to go slow. You know, Gus Malzahn's pretty good. He doesn't have the weapons yet at Auburn, I don't think, to run the way he wants. But he'll slow it down on you. He doesn't always go fast. He'll go fast when he needs to. But when he thinks the defense is ready for a fast play, he'll slow it down. So it's kind of a feel for the game. You know, that's the new play call now is gauging your tempo, when to go fast, when to go slow. It's not just a play call itself. And so some guys have a good feel for that, some don't. But, you know, what Baylor's doing is pretty outrageous. I know they haven't really played anybody yet, but you know, they're running the ball all over you, and that's a team you wouldn't necessarily equate with great running backs per se. I mean, they've had some good ones, but, you know, you think of RG3 and a great passing game and a quarterback running, but now, you know, they got Strunk, and then, you know, they can run that power game. Oklahoma State can do that too, although they did look very good the other day. But you know, they have a good element there. And so, you know, to answer your question, yeah, I think you have to have a few elements to separate yourself from a gimmick. A gimmick offense can put up a lot of yards, but doesn't do much else. But you know, depends on how you define gimmick too, because a lot of offenses are just playing in a bad league. You know, they're not really facing good defenses, so they have to create something that's advantageous for them.
That's true. I got you on that one. That's one of my favorite, that the situational speed is the thing that I've, as just a fan of football, something that I've really enjoyed seeing. I know that Oregon, you know, in really big games, I feel like Chip Kelly was doing that a lot at Oregon, the sort of, you know, you would be on yellow. It was almost like green light, yellow light, red light. And then all of a sudden, everything would be kind of normal paced, and then it speeds up. And I feel like the Patriots right. kind of do that a little bit at the NFL level, too, where there's certain situations. Yeah. I mean, I love the entire offense knows third and one, regardless of situation, you sprint to the line and run a play.
Right. That's yeah, it. And the thing about Oregon is, their time of possession isn't very high. It's not like they're just milking the clock. I mean, they can score really fast and they're off the field, but their rhythm is intact. And it's all about rhythm. And the reason why Stanford beat them is because they were just milking the clock, and then Oregon's not on the field very much. So when they get back on, you know, they're just not comfortable.
It's not
you're scoring on your own terms, you know. Yeah, if you're scoring on your own terms, no matter how you do it, as long as it's you imposing your will on the other team, then, you know, you're going to be in a rhythm.
Fast Football airs Tuesdays at 3 Eastern on CBS Sports Network. It replays a lot. What's the first air?
Yeah, it's 5 Eastern on Tuesdays, and then it replays at 9. So, yes, please watch. I mean, we try to be creative with it. A lot of different interpretations of fast football, but everything's fast now. It's not just the speed of the snaps per game and the yards. It's about, you know, players being fast. I mean, everybody wants things fast now, whether it's coffee or football. and there's a lot of science that goes into it, too, and how teams prepare their athletes to go faster and to kind of maximize their potential. So it's pretty cool.
Very, very cool. Be sure you tune in on Tuesdays. You do it with Bruce Feldman, Brent Stover. Lots of guests stop by. Very enjoyable. Are you going to be at Ohio State Northwestern?
I'll be there, yeah. Just a nice short drive for me to Evanston. And yeah, I mean, game day is going to be there. And I think the last time game day was there, it snowed. There was a blizzard, and this should be a lot cleaner. We've had absolutely perfect weather the last 5 months, 78 every day. So it's been nice.
Braxton Miller.
A nice crisp fall day.
Yeah, classic football day in Evanston on Saturday. What's your sort of take on this game? Because as I will say initially, Northwestern, you know, obviously coming off the 10-win season, nice start a little bit, but you know, you particularly had the Cal game after seeing sort of what Cal has done since then, maybe I've downgraded Northwestern a little bit, and I see Ohio State as sort of a heavy favorite, particularly with Braxton Miller back. Defense played really well against Wisconsin. What's your early take on this game?
Well, if Northwestern can kind of capitalize on the intangibles they'll have in place, this is as big a stage as they've had in a very long time, colliding with a 4-0 start and Pat Fitzgerald being another hot name again, although he was a few years ago when he turned down Michigan. But everything's colliding at the right time for them. And, you know, they have, talent-wise, clearly Ohio State has more firepower. But if you can get Ohio State's defense on a bad day, I just don't get the sense Ohio State's been all that pleased. Urban Meyer's been pleased with their start. And then, of course, Braxton's been out. You know, I think the offense will be fine. But the Wisconsin, I didn't get to watch the whole game because I was covering LSU-Georgia, but you know, Aberderis, the receiver, what, he had like 150 yards in the first half on Bradley Roby, who's supposed to be one of the best corners in the country. You know, I just don't get the feeling Ohio State's all that pleased with a defense that's pretty young. You know, Ryan Shazier was the only returning front seven guy, really. And so, you know, if Northwestern can get to an early lead, that'll go a long way, you know, with Kane Coulter and company and Benrick Mark. I mean, with those two guys, anything's possible, but Ohio State should have the edge overall, but I think it's going to be closer than people think.
From TV, and I haven't rewatched, so I'm not positive, it seemed like Ohio State was completely fine with letting Joel Stavi beat them. Like, they came into the game saying, if you're going to beat us offensively, you're just going to do it through the air because, you know, we've got to be able to stop James White and Melvin Gordon.
Right, and I think they'll probably do the same a little bit with Northwestern, make them beat him with the passing game. You know, Venerick Marks got that much respect. So, yeah, I mean, that's a format. And that was probably smart by Ohio State in a lot of ways. I mean, they, you know, Wisconsin got some yardage up, but do you really trust Joel Stavi to beat you? Who's decent. You know, he's a decent quarterback, but is he ready to really tear you up like that and win a game like Murray did the other day? I don't know.
Yeah.
So, it's probably the right play by Ohio State, but, you know, they're an interesting spot. I just don't know if they're a dominant team yet. I don't know what to make of Ohio State. I think they could run the table, or they could just kind of drop a curious game, and maybe this is the one.
Yeah, I sense some uncertainty with the Buckeyes in your eyes, Mr. Fowler. Not quite ready to buy them as an undefeated Big Ten champ.
Yeah, and you know, they've lost a few guys to injury too, and I think the difference is I think they'll be up for this game, considering the stage and. You know, Northwestern is not an unknown commodity anymore. You know, they've kind of had some buzz for a few years now, and so Urban will get them up for this one. I'm not totally down on them. I don't know if they're a dominant team yet.
Speaking of, Washington and Stanford, another, I would say probably maybe the second biggest game, but an interesting game. Are you buying Miami as dominant in the ACC Coastal Division? With Georgia Tech coming to town, I have not been unbelievably impressed with Miami's offense this year, and I sense that this might be a potential upset for the Canes.
Yeah, that's the thing with Miami is Stephen Morris has that NFL arm, the power arm, and everybody's impressed with it. And I think he can get hot like he did a few times last year, but his numbers aren't great. There are a lot of, you know, a few suspect performances, or if not suspect, but just kind of, they don't really stand out. And you don't know what you have with the receivers. There's depth on the O-line. The O-line's pretty good, or at least they look the part.
Right. They're big. And they're tall. They look like a set of future NFL offensive linemen on the depth chart, height and weight.
Right. But if you stop Duke Johnson – and you load up on him, then what's Miami's counter? Sometimes I just don't know what that is, if they can beat you with their second move. And so that's a question they need to answer, and I'm not sure on that yet. I think they're better than Georgia Tech. Tech's a little better than I thought they'd be, to be honest. I wasn't all that high on them coming in. But, you know, and we can't sleep on Virginia Tech. They've kind of survived a little bit. They're playing with a lot of youth, but they've gone through a lot early on. Playing Bama and then, you know, barely skating by on ECU and Marshall. And so, but, you know, they look pretty – I mean, that defense looked really good the other night. I know Tech can't really throw it, but, you know, Kyle Fuller and company is pretty impressive.
Yeah. That game and Florida State, Maryland, another interesting game. I think, are you thinking the Terps get brought back to earth, falling out of the top 25 and emerge 4-1 from Tallahassee, or do you think they can pull the upset?
Well, I'll never, you know, they talk about Clemsoning.
Yeah.
But, you know, Seminoling is almost as prominent under Jimbo Fisher. They lose those curious games. And Maryland will be brought back down to earth a little bit, but they're pretty good. I mean, they're certainly a bowl eligible team or better. You know, right now maybe put them what, fifth or sixth in the league overall.
Yeah, I'd put them behind. Yeah. I'd put them third in that Atlantic division. And yeah, this, I think you can call it ACCing or Go ACC or ACC Atlanticing. You could sort of put Clemson and Florida State together on that one, but I think the Terps are right there behind them, ahead of. Maybe ahead of the Wolfpack and the rest of the Atlantic Division.
Right, and what they showed the other day, being West Virginia without really needing Stephon Diggs, which is a little surprising, but T.J. Brown getting settled in a little bit. Just the quarterback chaos they had last year isn't a problem now, and sometimes the breaks go your way, and sometimes it's as simple as being healthy, because that defense is solid. So, yeah, Maryland's got a shot, and they could be a 7 or 8-win team, but it seems like Jameis Winston has that other gear he can turn on. He needs to show that he can't do it at this point, because everything he's shown so far says that he can.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, he's going to be fascinating to watch moving forward, but this is another test for him.
Absolutely. He is Jeremy Fowler. You can follow him on Twitter at JFowlerCBS. Jeremy, thank you so much for taking some time out of your day to join us on the Ion College Football Podcast.
No problem, man. Anytime.
For Jeremy Fowler, I'm Chip Patterson. Thanks so much for listening.